Hi, welcome to Sound Notes. This is Dave Pryor. I work for Leading Agile, and the podcasts that we do here are with the coaches and the trainers and the other folks that work at Leading Agile. And what we do is we talk about different things that they're encountering in the field when it comes to working with companies who are trying to adopt Agile or helping them extend Agile into different areas. So we've done a number of different interviews so far. This one is with Chris Bagnola, and we've done, this is our third one. So Chris, thank you. You've given up a lot of time for these. I really appreciate you taking the time out for that.
Hey, no problem. I'm totally enjoying doing these with you.
So far we've talked, what we focus on, Chris and I focus on in the interviews is innovation. And we had one, the first one where we talked generally, you know, what do we mean by business innovation? And last time we focused a little bit more on how to get ready to get set up for it. This podcast is going to be on system design. So this is a little bit deeper into the topic. So if you were looking for a little more meat there, you're in the right place. So Chris, before we get into it, can you briefly explain for folks who haven't heard the other two podcasts what your role at Leading Agile is?
Sure. So my name's Chris Spagnolo. I'm an innovation coach doing a lot of lean startup work inside of Leading Agile. And what we're doing now is we're building a service offering around helping enterprises just really leverage lean startup techniques and practices to become a little bit more innovative.
Okay. So in taken in the context of the compass, I mean, a lot. So one of the things that Leading Agile does is helps organizations figure out where they fit in terms of some different quadrants of predictability and the ability to innovate and things like that. A lot of organizations start out in a very traditional, predictive, kind of constrained, waterfall-ish mindset. And when they think about Agile, the sort of Valhalla off in the corner is basically lean startup. I mean, you want to be totally disruptive and innovative, and agility is just going to be the thing that fuels that engine, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely. And those are the kind of things that we want to try to introduce is, you know, that if you look at the quadrants like you had talked about in our compass, you know, when we start getting teams to be more agile, you're right, it's more about predictability and things like that. But when we move to that upper right-hand corner, it's about really decoupling teams from any kind of dependencies and really freeing them up to be more innovative. So that's where the work that I'm doing, the stuff that we've been talking about, that's kind of where it lives in terms of the whole Leading Agile philosophy.
Okay, so before we get into the system design part, the reason I brought up the quadrants is because what I wanted to touch on briefly was a lot of the traditional organizations who are going to get really excited about the idea of Agile and what it can deliver and really excited about innovation in general, the journey, it's not like a just hop on the bus, get off, we drop you off in innovation land. There's stages that you're going to probably have to grow through. I mean, it may not be something where you just flip a switch.
Right. And that's something we're kind of working on and doing, actively experimenting with. And, you know, the original thought process was that, you know, moving somebody right to that upper right quadrant and going right to innovation was a failure mode. And it probably is a failure mode if you don't kind of move through the whole rest of that compass and have the underlying structures to support that innovation group. So, yeah, I would say we're actively experimenting that area right now.
What do you mean by failure mode?
Well, we think that, if you don't have teams moving to Agile, becoming more predictable, becoming more stable, delivering in a ready fashion, if we just threw somebody out there into an innovation group and said, you know, there's really no bounds, we're going to work more in a Kanban fashion, it's going to be total flow, that could work, right? But when they're done with testing the business model and they hit on something that's reached product, you know, market fit, they get to the point where it's hard for them to deliver it. They've been used to working in this kind of chaotic mode of, you know, startup land. Actually throwing that back to the organization to become a maintainable, sustainable product requires teams that are more agile, right? So we kind of have to have all that groundwork laid to throw it back to the organization.
So you've got to like, you know, make sure that the field is ready before the thing can actually grow up and survive.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So system design. What do you mean when you talk about system design?
Okay, so system design to me is really taking the holistic approach to things, right? It's looking at the bigger picture. So what we see happen a lot is like people who are designers or the decision makers, they kind of see a problem, right? But then they define that problem really narrowly and they don't really identify any of the causes or connections to that problem. So all that really does is just shift the problem or multiply your problem. So when we think about like whole system design, which is the complete opposite of this disintegrated approach, usually we get these really lasting solutions that have multiple benefits across the organization, right? So usually in that former example, we're optimizing just isolated parts of a system and hope that that optimization makes some difference. And it usually results in a lot more complexity to the system and a lot of inefficiencies. So what's usually missing is this sense of a bigger picture. So systems design, in my mind, helps us see that bigger picture and optimize the entire system. And the foundations for designing an appropriate system like that, that looks at the broader, bigger picture, are some of the values and the things that we discussed last time. So if we kind of come up with these foundational values of what we want to get out of the system, then we can build a system that's actually addressing a much bigger picture. And we can start to filter all of our structures, our processes, strategies, practices, all of those things. If we filter them through the lens of those values, then we've optimized the entire system, right? And we're not looking at just small pieces. So that's what I think of when I think about it.
Can you give some examples of both like a system design approach and what you mentioned in the beginning, which was you called it disintegrated. Could you, for folks who aren't really familiar with that, could you give like a simple example of it?
Okay, so let's go with an analogy on this one instead of a solid organizational example. So think about a car in general, an automobile. And your car is a giant system, right? It goes down the road and it's actually a system of systems. If we're driving down the road and we feel like the car's not quite stopping the way we want it to stop, right? We go and optimize the brakes. So, or in a disintegrated approach, we would look at it and go, oh, there's something wrong with the stopping power of the car, so let's go fix the brakes, and maybe we change the brake pads, and that improves our stopping a little bit, right? But we didn't look at the whole entire system for stopping the car, right? We just looked at a small isolated component of it. But there's a lot more to stopping a car, right? We have tires, we have deceleration, we have a whole bunch of things that go into that. So if we looked at all of those things and said, we want this car to stop faster and smoother, we could look at a whole bunch of different things. We could look at, you know, the shocks that are on the car and the suspension on the car. And I'm so not a car guy, so this is, I'm probably totally missing.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, yeah. It almost seems to me like what you just described is why so many organizations fail when they try to adopt Agile. Like they just say, let's go fix the team or whatever and forget about the rest of the – there's no holistic view of everything.
Right, and that's the problem with this innovation stuff too, is we look at it and we go – okay, we have a competitor who's beating us because they're giving our product away. Let's find out how we make our product cheaper. And like making our product cheaper is the disintegrated approach, right? Because we're just competing on one isolated piece of it.
You treat the symptom instead of the disease.
Right. Instead of looking at it and saying, why did we completely miss this picture on making our product cheaper in the first place? There might be a whole lot more there. So if we start looking at the causes and the connections between why that organization was able to give our product away for free or cheaper or something like that, we could start to look holistically at what else can we be doing to make our product a better offering that people would actually want to pay for? What can we do to reduce the cost of our product? What can we do to work with that competitor? What can we do with the data that we might have that's supporting that product? There's lots of different ways that we can start looking at that broader system. And then it may be things internally that have to do with practices or processes that are kind of inhibiting our innovation around that space as well.
Okay. All right. So that, I think that's pretty clear. So if an organization that wants to move in this direction, set up innovation centers, which we talked about in the last interview, how do they need to begin to look at that from a systemic standpoint?
Yes, that's a good question. And I know we talked earlier offline, and we were talking about this HBR article this week, and it's called You Need an Innovation Strategy. And it was really interesting to me because it kind of woke me up a little bit about, A, there are different types of innovation, and B, there are questions we need to be thinking about strategically before we even move into this area of let's go design a system, right? So the guy who wrote the article, Gary Pisano, he had four really good questions for starting off with, but it kind of left you wanting, right? It was, you know, his first question to me was the most important is, what are you expecting this whole innovation thing? How are you expecting that thing to create value for your customers and your company? And to me, that's the most important question, because before we even get to talking about what kind of structure we want, like understanding what kind of value we're trying to create and why we're at, like what type of innovation we're trying to tackle, like different structures really address different types of innovation in better ways, right? So really having a high level plan or a strategy around what your innovation system is going to look like really starts with that question, right?
So this is, so just if folks are listening and they want to find it, so the HBR reprint number is R1506B, and this is in the June 2015 issue. And I read the article about 2 weeks ago, and I thought it was pretty cool as well. And I'm sure there's lots of folks out there who are reading it now are like, damn, we need to get some innovation going. Let's go get some of that. And the article ends with this challenge for leadership, which is like, go have a strategy, go find innovative people. And it doesn't, my issue with it was it sets people up to completely trip over themselves because there's nothing tactical.
Right. And that's the problem I kind of saw with the article. I mean, I thought it was a great article and I think it's a great jumping off point. But, you know, just saying go have a strategy is not enough, right? I think you need a good innovation strategy combined with good practices, good processes, good structures. That, to me, equals a good innovation system. So if we're talking from a systems design point of view, or if we think about the car analogy, right, the disintegrated approach is, oh, go have an innovation strategy and everything will kind of be great after that. And it's not true, right? We need the whole rest of the vehicle to get us where we're going. So that's where building the right structures, and we'll talk a little bit about structures and what they look like, but building the right structures, giving them a process to follow, giving them practices, giving them appropriate metrics, right? All of those things together build that nice system that we want.
So where I'm kind of like caught up in the whole, like, to me, it's like if I read an article that said, go buy a safe car, and I don't understand what a safe car is. We say they need an innovation strategy. Where do they get information to begin to know what questions to ask? I mean, is it just go find an innovation coach, or are there sources they can turn to start to build the vocabulary and the baseline knowledge that they need to be able to talk about this stuff?
Yeah, I don't know that there are a ton of sources out there that really do what you're asking. Okay.
You and Bland.
Yeah. So, you know, you can go out, you can hire a coach, but I think what you really want to do is you want to sit down and understand, like, what is it from an innovation perspective that we're missing out on? You know, a lot of times it's this whole, you know, there's a competitor who's kind of beating us and they're taking all of our customers. And that's not always the sole reason for innovating, right? If you look at lots of these kind of established innovation labs. And in the article they talked about, was it Corel, the glass maker? Yeah. So, you know, you're looking at them and like, they've done innovation for a really long time. And like, I remember Corel as being like the plates on my grandmother's table. And then you read the article and realize like they're
Corning.
Corning. Yeah, not Corel. Yeah. So, you know, if you look at Corning now, they're making like all these amazing glasses for all these different purposes and, you know, mobile devices and stuff. And they didn't do it because they had a competitor breathing down their neck. They looked at it and said, look, we have a really cool core competency at doing stuff. We just need different business models to sell this thing, right? Or different ways to use what we know how to do.
But there's also other stuff that happened. I mean, the whole thing that they explained in the article about the way that, you know, fiber optics change and stuff like that. I mean, their milkshake was disappearing.
It was, but they were smart enough to see that, right? So that's what you need is kind of this heads-up thinking of something's happening in the market space and we need to address it. And Kodak is probably a great anti-example of that, right? They kept their heads down and, you know, they really kept focusing on film cameras and you know, the replaceable cartridges of film and everything else when digital photography came in and ate their lunch, right? So that wasn't a single competitor who did it to Kodak. It was a complete shift in the market, right? So you need to be able to have that foresight and understand what's going on in your market and where things are going with technologies. And that's easier said than done because a lot of times, last time we talked about the status quo kind of makes you get heads down and focus on what we're good at and what we know how to do, right? But as an organization, you need to have groups that are at least picking their heads up and constantly looking at market changes, both in terms of technologies and new business models that can end up disrupting you.
Yeah, I always, whenever people bring up Kodak, I think how much it must suck to have been on the team that was like, yeah, screw digital photography. Because if they invented it before everybody else, if you were on that team, everybody's constantly picking on you. But, and that is got to be a hard thing. I mean, any company that has success is trying to maximize that and push its focus on that. But that does sort of put you in the position of turning into Justin Bieber. I mean, you become successful enough to where you believe your own hype and then you're irrelevant because somebody else is doing some brand new thing.
Right. And, you know, it's not to say that we should, you know, last time I think somewhere in the conversation I had mentioned, you know, routine innovation as not being interesting. And maybe that's a personal bias for me, right? But routine innovation on stuff that you are good at, you know, like if you're good at something, keep doing that. You know, you can't stop doing that because that's your current business. But that routine innovation is, you know, you're leveraging the existing business model, you're leveraging your existing competencies, and you're good at that, right? And you can keep making local innovations in small areas, right? But it's not going to be something that's going to be disruptive and bring about a new market change. And, you know, if you only focus on that one type of innovation, that's where you get lost in the marketplace, right? So what we're asking is that organizations start kind of diversifying their innovation portfolio, right? Instead of just looking at their existing products and innovating only on those, start looking at these different quadrants that this article had mentioned as well. And it's, you know, some of them are just around new business models. We have great core competencies, and this is the Corning thing, right? We have great core competencies at glass and materials technologies. Let's keep doing that. We'll probably come up with some cool new technologies along the way as well. But generally, it's new business models. How can we sell this thing different ways? Then you've got like the radical that he defines as, you know, leveraging your existing business model, but now you need new technical competencies. And then architectural is both, right? New business models and new technical competencies altogether. So the stuff we've been talking about, this whole lean startup, really sits in that disruptive quadrant, right? We're not really talking about coming up with earth-shattering new technologies. It's more about new business models and rapidly testing those.
So I want to go back to the routine thing for a second, because when you were talking about it, something popped into my head that I hadn't thought about before. The case could be made that if you take the sort of moneyball approach to innovation and say, it's not about the grand slam, it's about getting on people on base and moving them around the diamond. I can see where somebody could say, well, you know what, if we can just have these little wins, that's going to keep us going. But how do you even do that if you don't even have any sense of innovation? How do you create routine innovation? Are you going to set up a whole innovation center just for a bunch of little wins?
No, and I don't think that's what you want to set up an innovation center for, right? Like, to me, when I think about routine innovation, the way it's being described in this article especially, is this is stuff that product teams should be doing all the time, right? And this is the product owner or the product manager keeping your ear to the ground, really keeping a good, solid feedback loop between yourself and your product team and your customers, and making sure that you're understanding what the customers want or are expecting from your current products, right? So I'm not looking at that as go build a whole separate organization to do this kind of stuff.
Adding value into what you're already delivering.
Yeah, and I think that exists in the current organization, right? You just have to hone that skill, and that's a product management competency, right? And that's something product managers are really on the hook for, is constantly expanding and innovating on the products that they currently own.
So let's say you're talking about the iPhone, new features in the iPhone, is that a routine innovation or is it more on the disruptive side? Like Apple Pay, what's that?
Oh, that's a great question.
It's a total disaster. Bad bet, but maybe not. Or the watch. Is disruptive.
So the watch is new technology though, right? So that's brand new technology, and it's a new business model, sort of. So that's somewhere between like radical and architectural stuff. It's not really disruptive in my mind, but although I guess it could. I don't know. I don't think it's a new business model. I think their business model is still pretty much the same, but it's just a new technology. But to your question about Apple Pay, that's a great question, right? Because that's really looking at the iPhone and saying, okay, we've got this thing. It's, you know, quite a few years old at this point. How do we keep this thing alive, and how do we keep innovating new features, you know, whether it's in iOS or whether it's the actual hardware or if it's a combination of both? And I think that's fairly routine at this point, just because of where we are in the life cycle of that product, right? We're not doing anything super new or amazingly disruptive with it, but in the same sense, Apple Pay is kind of a new business model, right? So it goes out and, well, I wouldn't say it's new. I guess
it's new for Apple. I guess that's one of the things we should kind of couch it with, is Apple's not so much a disruptor as they are they're really good at finding all the pieces and putting them together in a better package.
Yeah, they really are. And to me, that borders on routine, right? It's we know we have, but now we're just going to go find these other pieces that look really cool. And I think Apple is slowly starting to move from being that huge disruptor to something a little bit less than that, right? Because if you come back to your example of Apple Pay, I mean, Google had a payment system way before Apple did, you know, and it was probably better. It's just that we're not sure if the marketplace is even ready for that. And that, to me, that's a business model thing of, are there enough people who even really want to use this thing? And that's what, to me, is disruptive. And that's where this whole lean startup thing comes in, is testing these business models really quickly to say, yes, this thing is going to fly.
So before we get into that, I want to ask you one more question about the Google Pay versus Apple Pay thing. So this, to me, creates a really interesting question, because it's easy to say go be disruptive. And you can argue Google is very disruptive, which they have been in their history. But Google Pay, or whatever they actually call it, they don't have the emotional trust that people have placed in Apple historically. So they may be more reluctant or more hesitant to go towards it, because, like, yeah, Google, that's mail and search. Like, why would I give them my credit card information? Where, like, Apple, people can't give them credit card information fast enough because they have this emotional connection. So I guess one of the questions I want to ask you is, if I'm in a company and I want to set up an innovation center because I don't want somebody else drinking my milkshake and I want this disruptive thing, there's more than just creating a disruptive product. You have to have a mindfulness, I guess, about the way the public perceives you. Or is that something you just suss out through the experiments that you're about to talk about?
I think you can do one. That's a really loaded question.
Yeah, it's like four questions at once. So yeah. It's an experiment. I'm just trying to see what you respond to.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I like it. Yeah, you know, part of that is really wrapped up in branding and brand awareness and brand loyalty. And Apple's done an amazing job of cultivating that, right? They're probably one of the best examples of how to brand your company and how to get that brand loyalty. I remember doing a presentation, it's probably like 8 years ago now, before Apple was really hitting it big. And at that point, there were tons of fanboys. I mean, in my presentation, I had like pictures of all these people with Apple tattoos. You know, you don't see people running around with like Google or Microsoft tattoos, right? So to me, there is a branding aspect of, yeah, whatever Apple launches, the guys who are the fanboys or the women who are the fangirls of the product, they're going to go out there and grab that thing no matter what. So they have a huge base to go experiment with, and they've got huge financial backing that they can take big risks with, right? But we're not, generally, most enterprises we're talking about, they're not Apple, right? Right. They're something else.
They have to have an awareness of their public's tolerance for stumbling.
Right, and that's why last time, I think we were talking about autonomy when I brought up the point of potentially doing something off-brand if you're worried about brand protection or things like that. So branding definitely comes into this whole innovation equation, especially with testing new business models on things that may be outside of the scope of what you're known for doing or have trust for doing. And sometimes people might be more trusting of a new organization than the enterprise. So you kind of have to understand where your trust value lies with your customer base.
Okay. And so if you are wanting to set something like this up, I mean, can you talk a little bit about the kind of structure you need to put in place? Like, one of the things we talked about before was entrepreneurship and how important it is to have clarity around that for the people that are going to be involved with this stuff.
Yeah, so I kind of think of like the spectrum of structures, right? And depending on the type of innovation you want to do, I think each one of these structures is viable and valuable in and of itself, right? The one that we'll talk about at the end of the scale, it's kind of the place where I've been living with organizations and trying to get people to think about implementing these lean startup things. But if you go back to sort of what I think of as like the scale, I kind of think of Skunk Works out there, right? And that's where, you know, Skunk Works, the way I define it, is like the organization's going to go out and they're going to select the best and brightest from the organization, put them off in some separate facility, assign them a task and say, go fulfill this predefined strategic priority kind of thing. That's very directed. There's not a whole lot of autonomy there, right? But it's an innovation structure. It says there is a strategic objective. We don't know how to meet it now. go over in this building and figure it out, right? And this is like the Lockheed Martin was great at doing Skunk Works kind of stuff. They would send people off. They would go invent really crazy, cool new stuff that met a very well-defined strategic objective. So that's kind of one way of doing innovation. It is very directed. It doesn't give a whole lot of autonomy. And a lot of times, the lessons that get learned over in a Skunk Works, a lot of times like a Skunk Works ends up getting put under wraps, and there's a lot of secrecy around it because they don't want things to leave that group and get out into the general public. So even the organization, the enterprise itself, gets shielded from what's going on in there. So there's not a lot of learning, and there's not a lot of lessons that or value that makes it back to the organization from the Skunk Works until the product's released, it sells, and it's going.
So you talked about Lockheed Martin and things like that. If people aren't familiar with Skunk Works, are you talking about sort of this clandestine secret project team, right?
Right, yeah.
And any organization, regardless of what field they're in, ideally should be able to find a way to set that up.
Yeah, this is an easy one to do, yeah.
Okay, so what are other options that you have? Like, if that's not something you can figure out to how to fund or get support for, what's another way to go about doing this?
So another way is like we talked about it a little bit last time, this whole entrepreneurship, right? And that to me is kind of like open-ended Skunk Works. It's really looking at commercializing employee ideas. It's the suggestion box. It's the, hey, come and pitch ideas, and if something looks good, we'll fund it, right? So it's a really cheap, easy way to get people thinking creatively in the organization, stimulating some innovation to start happening, and really start percolating ideas up that are viable. So the problem that I see with those is a lot of times, and not all the time, but a lot of times, like those type of programs, they really support like the sustaining products that you already have, right? So it's not like the disruptive or radically different innovation. It's usually on products that exist or taking a product and doing some of that more routine innovation on it, but not always. Sometimes we get some really good stuff out of those programs too. The other things that you find in like entrepreneurship programs are, you know, I kind of put hackathons under that thing where, you know, every quarter we'll take a week or 2 weeks off from our regular day-to-day work and do some hackathons and then see what kind of ideas come out of that, and maybe we'll fund them, maybe we won't, we don't really know. So it's a little more open-ended. It's not secretive like Skunk Works. The only problem is a lot of times those ideas get lost in the organization. Like if they don't get picked up this time around in, you know, in the current cycle of innovation or hackathon or whatever we're doing, a lot of times they get dropped by the roadside and we forget about them. And then those innovations down the line could be really important ones. So there are pros and cons to doing that kind of innovation.
So let me ask you a question about this last part. Like you mentioned hackathons as an example. One thing that I've been thinking a lot more about since we started talking through this stuff, in terms of not just the creativity, but the ability to continually function in that kind of, you know, let's just jam on it until we get something cool going that people will pay for mindset, is it's like you're training for something. I mean, if you're not constantly working out at that and trying to get better at it, you're going to end up pulling a muscle. So it's almost like if every other week you're like, yeah, every other week I'm going to just walk outside and run 20 miles, but the rest of the time I'm not going to run at all. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a, I don't know, it just seems almost like an unhealthy way to try to foster that. It's like binge innovation.
Yeah, you know, the running is a great analogy, and I'm a runner, marathoner, trail runner, and that really hits home with me when you said that, because I kind of think you're right. Like, right now, I literally have nothing on my calendar. I'm not training for anything. So I kind of fall into the practice of I'm not eating how I usually eat. My running is really sporadic, and some days I run, some days I don't.
You're living sometimes, like the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah. But you can damn well bet that when I put a marathon on the calendar, I am totally structured about what my training approach looks like, what my diet is, what my weight is. I mean, like, I'm thinking a ton about all that stuff all the time, right? That's the same thing with having an innovation strategy. Like, if you're just doing entrepreneurship and it's this open-ended thing, there's no strategy, there's no direction to it. And last time, I know we had talked a lot about constraints, and, like, those are super important, right? Putting something on the calendar or saying, here's the kind of innovation we want to do, or here's why we want to do innovation, here's the area we'd like you to explore, that's a whole lot more directed. That makes you train every day, right? And it makes you think about, we have got to solve this problem. And Skunkworks does that, right? Entrepreneurship, not so much. It's a little more open-ended.
So that seems to run almost counter to a lot of what I would expect many people think of when they get to innovation or to Agile, is this idea of, well, the first thing that we have to do is create the scope, you know, the box that we have to figure out how to climb out of. But that framing of it is what kind of drives some of the creative focus, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, without some kind of focus, and that was one of the core values we defined last time we talked, was that this idea of focus. And without focus, we're just kind of wandering out in the wilderness hoping something's going to hit. Where if we're a little more focused on what we're doing, we have a much better shot at getting to that. So there are structures that are way more supportive of that, that allow some level of autonomy that the Skunkworks doesn't give you. Because Skunkworks just says, go solve this problem, right? And we already know the problem. It's predefined. Just go solve it, and you can solve it any way you want. Where like an innovation lab, or Trevor Owens is calling them innovation colonies, we're kind of fiddling around with words on what we really think that should be called, or decoupled teams is kind of where we're at right now. But, you know, those two structures, and we'll talk about them in a minute, but they give you a lot more autonomy. It says, we know we need to be more innovative. We want some disruptive innovation. We'd like some new business models. We know what our core competency is as an organization. We're not asking you to go develop something, some technology that we don't already have. Look at our existing technologies and let's find new ways in terms of a business model to approach these things. And I think those kind of structures give you that kind of focus with enough open-ended innovation where you can do something a little more disruptive.
Yeah, I want to go back to some stuff that you mentioned about the labs or the people that work in the labs. And this is some stuff that we talked about last week, which in going through and listening to that again, it just is like, I don't know, sticking in my head even more. So you've talked about entrepreneurship, and I'm going to work under the assumption that a lot of companies, if they want something like that, they're going to go try to find an entrepreneur who exists within the company. And so the parallel to that would be somebody like Steve Jobs, which is great to have. But if you don't have Woz, or you don't have creative people whose payoff is not, I'm going to get this many points on the final product, but I'm going to be given the freedom to find my way out of the box and to work around a bunch of creative people and to build really cool stuff. I mean, you need to have people that are in the game for the love of the game, not for the end result. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
And the other thing that I wanted to, we talked last time about different models and what do you do with the people when if the thing succeeds or fails. One of the things that we talked about was, I mentioned, you know, David Letterman's band. Like the payoff for those guys is that they get to play with all these amazing people every night. But the other thing about that, and thinking it over again, if you're setting up an innovation team, these people become experts at versatility. You bring them any idea, they can do great stuff with it. Mm-hmm. That's a capability. I mean, it's almost like you'd want to have like the D school within your own company, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And I know we're going to push metrics off for another conversation, but to me, like understanding that this, you know, an innovation lab or a colony or a decoupled team, whatever we're calling this stuff out on the far right side of the spectrum, like their whole mission is not really to create ROI for the company through product, right? What we're looking at here is developing innovation capacity. And that to me, that's what I feel like you're describing. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And then my next question, even though you just said we weren't going to talk about metrics until next time, is going to be, do people measure innovation capacity? And if so, how?
So that's a whole conversation, but we can kind of touch the tip of that iceberg, right?
So this is just tease it a little bit. So let's check the next step.
So this is a huge problem I see, actually, is that people don't understand how to measure that innovation capacity. So they look at it with traditional metrics of what's the ROI coming out of this team? Or, you know, we're looking at what's the revenue stream coming out of a product that they developed or something like that. And if we really look at them as a startup who they're out there testing new business models and they're just experimenting like crazy, the experimentation is actually the capacity we're trying to develop with this team. the bet is that eventually that risk is going to pay off down the line, that we made this investment in this team, and yeah, we're going to have a product that hits. But if we look at the team themselves and not the product they're developing, you know, we want to look at how many ideas are they considering? What does their flow look like, right? How many experiments are they running against those ideas? And not just any idea, but like ideas that are aligned with the innovation thesis or the innovation strategy. We want to look at the cost to getting to a prototype, right? How long did it take them to go from an idea to a prototype? How long did it take them to go from an idea to product market fit? And what was the cost behind that? And then ultimately that turns into a return on investment calculation. But before we hit any kind of product that's really giving us any revenue or returns, we have to have a valuable way of measuring that innovation capacity. So that's where I would go with that answer. And I think that's what a lot of organizations are kind of missing right now.
Okay. You've talked a lot about the decoupled teams. Can you go into that just a little bit more in case people aren't familiar with it?
Sure. So decoupled teams, this is something we're really struggling with exactly what this looks like, right? But what we think it looks like right now is that it's a really small team completely removed from the enterprise. Whether or not it needs to be a separate legal entity, I'm not sure. I think it can thrive either way. But what it has to be removed from is all the budgetary constraints, all the political constraints of the enterprise that we're trying to carve this out of. So we're really creating something new and different. And they are focused entirely on conceiving new products, validating the market for them. And by products, I'm really more talking about business models at the beginning, but really coming up with new business models, validating that model, and then shepherding that to product market fit until we feel like we have enough traction to get moving. And we want to do that with, over time, increasing reliability, decreasing cost, right? So we really want to develop a team that's separate and is going to test a ton of ideas really rapidly, and really cheaply.
And when you say validating the idea in the marketplace, it's doing so in a way that, I mean, we've talked before about how important the option of failure is, but if you're going to go out and test all this stuff in a marketplace, you need to have a safe way of doing it that's not going to destroy your current brand.
Right. And that's why I was kind of alluding to these off-brand kind of tests, right? Yeah. You can build this organization. That's why the separate legal entity is really appealing, because that is completely off-brand. You know, you have no connection to the organization anymore. The organization is acting more in the role of a venture capitalist investing in this new legal entity. But I'm not sure that you have to have that big of a line dividing between the two of them, right? So yeah, so this team, you know, not only are they separate from the organization, but they're going to have a different process that they're going to work with. And I kind of mentioned the validation word and the business model word. And everything that this team is doing is operating on a set of hypotheses, right? And what they're trying to do is rapidly validate or invalidate each one of those hypotheses until they get to a point where they go, yes, this thing flies in the market. We've got enough traction. It's ready to really become a product, right? And there are three pieces to the hypothesis. There's the customer part, there's the problem part, and then there's the solution component. And those are the kind of things that we really want to identify within this group, is we want to have them sit down and say, we are thinking really hard about these three pieces of our hypothesis. Write them down, understand what each one of those are, and then really dig in and understand the core assumptions that go against each one of those hypotheses. What are all the assumptions that we're making about our customers? What are all the assumptions we're making about problems and about solutions? And then what we want them to do is pick the riskiest assumption out of all of those, the one assumption that stands above all the others that says, if this assumption is invalidated, everything else falls apart. Then we want them to understand that they have to go out and build experiments and have a methodology to those experiments and a minimum success criteria around those experiments as well that says, yes, this thing's a success or a failure before we even move to the experiment. Then go run the experiment, then go through your learnings. What was invalidated? What was validated about this business model? What are the pivots we need to make? Do we need to kill the product? Do we persevere in the direction we're going? Or are there pivots to each one of those components of the hypothesis? And then we run through that again. And it's an iterative process until we feel like we have gotten all the risk out of this business model and we're seeing traction in the marketplace. It's ready to become a product.
So when it comes to testing the assumption, you just talked about how it's important up front to have a hypothesis to understand how you're going to measure success. We've talked before about things like, you know, how this stuff gets funded and when do we decide to return everybody to their desk. So if there's a measure of success, do you also need to have a measure of this is the kill point? Whether it be time or money or failed experiments or catastrophic results that you weren't expecting. I mean, do you, it's almost like a risk analysis kind of approach. Do you have a trigger point where you say, yeah, game over, we're moving on?
I think you sort of do. I think that one's a little more touchy-feely than a definite line in the sand. But, you know, when I think about this decoupled team, and I kind of talked before about the enterprise acting as the venture capitalist group kind of funding this new startup, I kind of think that if you make incremental investments, you kind of protect against some of that where we can have a valuation period. So if you say, hey, we're going to build this decoupled colony out here and they're going to go develop some new business model, they're going to test new ideas, but we're only going to give you, you know, $300,000 for the next 3 months. And when you guys are out of that, we need to sit down and have that conversation of, is this producing A, the innovation capacity we expected, and B, measurable results on some of your experiments that are showing that you're actually moving closer to product market fit. And product market fit is a little more touchy-feely than some of the other metrics that we would use. The innovation capacity is really easy. We can look at it and say, yeah, this team is coming up with tons more ideas than we ever did before. This is great. And, oh, by the way, it's moving to product market fit. And we can start to look at what we should have a total separate conversation about what product market fit is and the metrics around that. But yeah, I mean, there is this bright line at some point that says this thing's working or it's not. And then we make an incremental investment into that team. And every incremental investment is a vote of confidence that, yeah, this team's doing the right thing in terms of innovation and moving something along to that product market fit line.
Okay, cool.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it totally does. And I have one more for this podcast. So this one is about something that we talked about in kind of prep for this interview. When we got to the topic of system constraints, you talked about constraints for a lean creative system. And I was wondering if you could sort of explain what you mean by a lean creative system.
So lean creative system to me is just this idea. So back to the HBR article, right? If we look at the four quadrants that guy defined. That guy, Gary Pisano.
Gary Pisano, but also the quadrants are disruptive, routine, radical, and architectural.
Right. And you know, the whole lean creative system to me, anyway, lives inside this disruptive quadrant, right? It kind of lives in a spot where we're going to look at existing competencies we have, but we're going to test new business model ideas, and we're going to do those rapidly. So that's what I think of as a lean creative system. It's using lean startup techniques and processes to kind of constrain the system a little bit. It's using a set of constraints. It's using a set of values to build a more systemic approach to everything that we're doing. So when we look at the structure of that team, it comes back to looking at all the values that we had. Does the structure align to the values that we wanted to do? Do the processes align? And when we look at lean startup and some of the practices around that and bang them against those values that we talked about, it all starts to fit together and it builds that broader system approach to building out this innovation system.
Cool. All right. So we have a list of like 15, I think, topics to talk about. But so for the next time, if we focus on what we said before that we're going to focus on was how to measure success. So right. If you're listening to this, so check back for the next one, which will be probably in a week or two. And we're going to talk about, with respect to innovation in the organization, how do we measure success? How do we define what it is? How do we track it? How do we know if things are working or not? So, Chris, thank you very much for taking time out today for the interview.
Thanks, Dave. Totally enjoying this whole series. Thanks.
Yeah, me too.